to experience before, during, and after for it to qualify. Holding people to such high standards, or any standards, seems to invite feelings of isolation and loneliness. Which isn't to say I didn't feel isolated or lonely or struggle not to feel unwell. I did. Returning to my apartment still filled me with dread, especially in the winter when I was met by late afternoon darkness. Loneliness seemed to wait by the door to welcome me home. The sickening black mass in my stomach came and went. But the feelings and sensations passed in a way they hadn't before. The time I spent in solitude, or isolation, or loneliness, is bracketed. That's how it's punctuated for me now. Inside it are the changing cocktail of medications, the withdrawal symptoms, the suicidality, the nausea, Dr. M, the PHPs. Over, tucked away, inside each other. One night when I was teaching ESL at the community center in Brooklyn, I double-checked the answer to a grammar question about parentheses. The students worked in pairs, parsing workbook exercises in English, such a difficult language with its changing grammar rules and high-maintenance punctuation marks. I opened my copy of Warriner's English Grammar and Composition to the page on brackets. Brackets signify a double enclosure in a text. They're commonly used in citations, but can also indicate parenthetical thoughts. Thoughts inside thoughts. I am solitary, brackets, or am I isolated? They illustrate the way the mind works. Most minds, bracketed, or perhaps only my mind, with its reservations and clarifications and contradictions. One thought can be a statement, another a question. One can communicate certainty, another doubt. Though some grammarians say that brackets include unnecessary information, this is far from true. Brackets represent our internal lives, our deepest secrets. Rarely do we use brackets this way. Most grammarians would opt for commas or dashes, but brackets occupy the primary position on two keys on the QWERTY keyboard, while parentheses, which we use more often, are relegated to secondary positions above the 9 and the 0. Maybe we don't communicate through brackets to avoid experiencing the depths of ourselves. If commas are speed bumps, dashes open doors, and parentheses are hurdles to step over, then brackets are solid walls. The origins of brackets, once referred to as crotchets, are shrouded in mystery, pun intended. A sibling of parentheses and chevrons, brackets are said to have been invented at the turn of the 14th century by the Italian humanist and rhetorician Coluccio Salutati. Editors often use them to make comments and corrections on a text. In a twist of imagination, they show up in Samuel Richardson's 1748 epistolary novel Clarissa, a tome I've actually read, and in Lawrence Stern's 1759 novel Tristram Shandy, a tome I haven't, to express material omitted not by the editor or the author, which would later become common, but by the characters. Like marks of parentheses, brackets might be seen as broken pieces of what once was whole. Parentheses appear as a circle divided in two. Brackets are a broken square. They emit a feeling of enclosure, which is how I see myself during those years, walled off, the self alone with the self inside the self. Brackets, like human beings, are relational. At times they signal unnecessary information. At others, they draw attention to what's inside. Recently, someone reminded me that they hold space for words that may or may not yet exist. They communicate to the reader when someone's words have been altered. In quotations, they show when only part of a sentence is being quoted, but presented as a standalone clause. It's possible she has depression becomes, in brackets, she has depression. It can tell us when someone else's words have been manipulated, a boundary has been inserted to connect two voices, perhaps causing the meaning to change. Brackets clarify the context. She has an illness, brackets, bipolar. They nest information. She has an illness, bipolar, brackets, which she's been told is lifelong. They point out a typo or an error in the original text. She's really bipolar, sick. Not my error, someone else's. Listen, Dr. R said, holding up his hands, signaling me to wait. It isn't always clear. We were in his office in our respective leather chairs. I'd asked what he thought was my diagnosis. He gave me one. I nodded, though not in agreement. His diagnosis was his diagnosis, the DSM's diagnosis. How could I accept what wasn't valid? We made a follow-up appointment. I walked down the long hallway and rode the elevator to the lobby. The almost spring air outside was moist and cool. A last bit of winter wind blew down Chicago Avenue. Patches of ice melted on the sidewalk. 14. On stigma and disclosure. One morning, I woke with a moan, an audible moan, dark, bellowing, but not so loud that the neighbors would hear. I emailed my editor and then opened the blinds covering my window. It was oppressively sunny. Even the blue sky seemed wrong. It started the day before. A friend and I sat eating turkey sandwiches in the seating area of Whole Foods. She knew some of what I'd been through. I mentioned that I was going on the academic job market. She worked in human resources. I said, I'm a little worried about, oh, don't be. The stigma against mental illness. She glanced around and lowered her voice. It's so much better now. No, I'm worried about someone seeing this. On my phone, I pulled up an essay I'd published about one of my suicidal episodes. It had seemed like a good idea, writing as therapy, helping others by telling my story. But it was the first piece that came up in a Google search of my name. I imagined members of a hiring committee scrolling through the essay. It seemed as if I had to ask the magazine to take it down from their site. She looked down at the screen. She didn't read far before she said, "Yeah, maybe it's not a good idea to have that out there." Back in my office, I thought, no. Wasn't academia the upholder of open-mindedness? Didn't I work in the humanities? Didn't universities post in their job descriptions equal opportunities for people who have or have had a mental illness? A colleague read the essay. We sat in her office. "You cannot take this down," she said, and spoke of artistic freedom. When I asked what a hiring committee's response might be, she hesitated. "Maybe leave it off your CV and don't include it in your writing sample." Another colleague read it, his expression clouded with concern. "Definitely leave it off my CV. Definitely don't include it in my writing sample. Probably take it off the site." Stigma, which literally means a branding with a hot iron on the skin and figuratively a mark of disgrace against suicide, plays out in stereotypes, discrimination, and the prejudice that it's the act of someone with an unhinged mind. The nature of the stigma differs across genders, races, cultures, and socioeconomic classes, but it affects us all. It's done nothing to decrease suicide rates, which have increased over the past 20 years. Historically, suicide has been portrayed as weak, sacrilegious, a mortal sin, evil, demonic, criminal, selfish, egotistical, and the sign of a deranged mind. St. Augustine was the first to twist scripture and denounce self-murder as a sin. In the 4th century, he condemned it based on his interpretation of the 5th commandment. In his Confessions, he wrote, "God's command, 'Thou shalt not kill,' is to be taken as forbidding self-destruction." The idea that it was somehow a marker of insanity came from Elizabethan England. The only way to avoid being posthumously charged with self-murder was to be deemed non compos mentis. Otherwise, you'd be denied a Christian burial, have your body thrown naked into the ground, be skewered with a wooden stake, and have your family punished and impoverished. The suicide of a lunatic was accepted because it was to be expected, given their mental state. The DSM stigmatizes suicide. In the DSM-4, suicidality was considered either a symptom or complication of certain diagnoses, particularly mood disorders and substance abuse disorders. The DSM-5 proposed suicidal behavior disorder, SBD, which could be diagnosed in anyone who had attempted suicide any time in the past 24 months. 24 months. 2 years. That means that someone who has tried to end her life and survived a mental struggle, the intensity of which few can fathom, can continue to be labeled mentally ill for as long as 2 years, 1/5 of a decade. That's not a diagnosis, not treatment. That's condemnation and punishment. A sentence greater than many actual crimes. In my home state of Illinois, aggravated assault, a felony depending on the circumstances, can get less than a year. I'd never champion suicide. No one should have to experience a doubt that vicious. But it hasn't always been denounced as an act against God, nature, the state, the community, one's family, and oneself. Likewise, it has not always been treated as evidence of an unstable mind, not to the Stoics in ancient Greece, not to the ancient Romans, and not to Shakespeare, who often depicted suicides in his plays sympathetically. Not to many Enlightenment thinkers like David Hume, who practically argued in favor of it, mainly from his position as a rationalist in favor of personal freedom and against religious dogma. Not to African-American slaves, who saw it as an act of resistance and even power. Not to Emile Durkheim, who saw it as more a result of cultural and social factors than an individual's disposition or choice. Not to the French theorist Michel Foucault, who believed it to be a reasonable, deviant act censured unfairly by those in power. Still, I had good reason to believe I should take down the essay and hide it. The stigma was real. Mental illness and DSM diagnoses were one thing, but suicide was extreme. It crossed a line. What would my niece and nephew think if they knew? Who would want to be in a relationship with someone who'd wanted to end her life? How could a committee privy to that information hire me, given how competitive the market was, flooded with writers and PhDs who wouldn't, this was the assumption, cause them problems? When my editor's response finally arrived in my inbox, it was too long to be a simple yes right away. She said she understood my concerns, but the piece she wrote had been getting a lot of traffic. This wasn't meant in a more hits for the magazine way. It was reaching and helping people. And then there was the artist who'd done the artwork to consider. In many ways, the essay had become a collective effort and was no longer mine to take down. She asked me to think about it. At my appointment with Dr. R that day, I asked what he thought. He settled back in his plush leather chair and crossed his legs in a figure four. His eyes widened. He grimaced as if to say, "Tough one." "To some degree," he said, his chin bobbing in the affirmative, "you should keep your mental health history private. So no, in most professional environments, and especially in academia, people don't understand." He smiled that strange smile and shook his head. "Now, if you were applying to law school or med school, I'd say go for it. They love that shit." That night, in the blue of my laptop screen, I read my essay online again. I caught some mistakes and didn't agree with some of it. It seemed to have been written by someone else. How could someone write something like that? How could she talk about suicide so openly? I went to the window. The brick wall stared back at me. No one would hire someone who was once suicidal, who once knew the semicolon firsthand. More thoughts came. I had to hide the essay. In her next email, my editor told me it wasn't the magazine's policy to take published work off the site and offered to use only my first name and last initial and remove my bio so no one would recognize me. In a few weeks, she said, Google's algorithm would work its magic and no one would be able to link me to the essay again. I went for a walk through the park. The overcast sky was low to the ground. A thin fog made the red and yellow autumn leaves glisten. I should have felt unburdened, but my chest became heavy. I'd abandoned the essay and was pretending it wasn't mine. I felt empty. No diagnosis, no answer, no past. But I did have a past. On a similar afternoon the year before, I'd walked that same route. Same overcast sky, though no fog. Same leaves, same trees, same tree I'd wanted to hang myself from. Maybe taking my name off the essay, pretending it wasn't mine, was a wise way to control my life's narrative. Not that it would work. Each emergency room visit was on my medical record. My suicidal ideations could be found in Dr. C's and Dr. H's and Dr. M's notes. My 6 diagnoses, too, were permanent. Each had its own set of consequences. Bipolar alone would make it hard for me to adopt a child. Life insurance would be difficult to get. Back at my apartment, I pulled up the webpage with my essay on suicidal ideation by Sarah F. Sarah F. So close to anonymous. It wasn't me. It was the right thing to do. The only thing I could do. No one needed to know. At my next appointment with Dr. R, I told him I wanted off all my meds. He'd changed my diagnosis for the third time. I decided to live without one. If I wasn't going to accept a diagnosis and was going to hide my past, I couldn't be on meds. That wouldn't make sense. Dr. R crossed his legs in a figure four and settled back in his chair. I had a client, worst diagnosis you can have, schizoaffective disorder. I mean, bipolar topped with schizophrenia? Can't get worse than that. She was from a family of litigators, famous litigators. Not what a psychiatrist wants. I told her family what we needed to do. Her family informed me of what they thought we needed to do. As far as I knew, they didn't have a medical degree among them. But I said, fine, take her to Mass General, best in the country for this sort of thing, and get a second opinion. They flew her out to Boston on their private plane. The docs at Mass General disagreed with me. Fine. 6 weeks after her treatment started at Mass General, their daughter was worse. The family came back to me. We did what I'd said. It took time, but she got better. Once she was better, she said she wanted off the drugs. Fine. Slowly, we took her off them. Slowly. She's now an executive at Google. Off all meds. That's what I want, I said. He looked away. On his face was an expression of that's not going to happen, or maybe that wasn't the point of the story. He suggested we raise the dose of my SSRI. Why? I asked, my voice cracking. I'd managed to get off the antipsychotic and the lithium and quit the benzo in one day. I still hadn't known the dangers. So why not the SSRI and the lamotrigine? It's not worth it, he said. Those medications aren't hurting you. Low side effect profiles. I said I was determined. He uncrossed his legs and breathed deeply. Okay, we can try with the lamotrigine. I became enamored with the withdrawal community. Made up of lay people with no medical training, it encouraged people to get off their meds. The media had embraced it. A New York Times article on psychiatric drug withdrawal portrayed those going off psychiatric drugs as heroes struggling to overcome great odds and winning. The New Yorker ran a profile about, really a peon to, one withdrawal community leader, praising her for stopping her medications without medical supervision, becoming free and encouraging others and charging money to advise them to do the same. To be medication-free was to be mentally pure and psychopharmacologically virtuous. The withdrawal community was pill-shaming me, and I believed they were right. They preached the necessity of breaking free of psychotropic drugs without relying on my doctor's help. One site wrote, I was the only person who can decide if and how I'll taper off. Before I could enter the site, I had to click a box absolving them of responsibility for anything that happened as a result of reading such statements. I empathized with a blogger who wrote her doctor told her that if she really wanted off her meds, she'd just stop. Another blogger quipped that not getting off my medications was giving up. Another encouraged me to keep going. So I did. Physicians, researchers, and academics battle in print and on TV and on podcasts and at podiums as to whether psychotropic drugs save people or destroy them. The pro-medication side tends to be made up of psychiatrists, academics, and researchers with conflicts of interest so deep the studies read as big pharma pamphlets. The con, de-prescribe now side includes disgruntled psychiatrists and psychiatric survivors who tend to demonize psychiatric medications. The deprescribed nowers inadvertently scared me into wanting off my meds. Robert Whitaker's Mad in America podcast spoke of the dangers of psychopharmacology, the wonder drugs and breakthrough medications that reinforced diagnoses, the billions made by drug companies, the exclusively short-term benefits of psychiatric medications, and the toxic, dangerous long-term effects. Patient advocate psychiatrist Peter Breggin said psychiatric drugs were toxins and didn't cure mental illnesses. They were the reason for them. They aren't correcting biochemical imbalances. They are causing biochemical imbalances. Whitaker, Breggin, and others convincingly argued that antipsychotics and anti-anxiety medications actually produced psychosis and anxiety. A week later, I stood behind the podium teaching my Introduction to Literature course. We were discussing Amy Tan's essay, Mother Tongue. In it, Tan tells of the discrimination her mother faced because she speaks what Tan calls broken English, a mix of English and Chinese grammar, punctuation, and syntax, words put together with comma splices and without verbs. A student said that the point of the essay wasn't about, like, speaking like perfect English, but to appreciate bilingualism. I started to sweat. My heart raced. More sweating. A student raised his hand and shared that he was the child of first-generation immigrants and had had the same experience with his parents. Soon, sweat had soaked my bra, my camisole, my shirt, and was starting to go through my blazer. Luckily, my blazer was black, so my students couldn't see. After class, in my office, I draped my clothes on my bookshelf to dry. Dr. R had assured me that going off the lamotrigine caused no withdrawal symptoms. I called and left him a message. When he returned my call, I said I couldn't go through it again. He reassured me, genuinely, that it was okay. We'd hit on the lowest dosage I could stand. He told me to go back up on the lamotrigine to where we were. Maybe it was okay. Maybe DSM diagnoses could be fictitious without it meaning that medications don't help some people. Drug studies are based on false DSM diagnoses. They test using the DSM's random symptom lists, using as subjects people they can't prove have the same disorder, or any disorder. But maybe I could reject the DSM's diagnoses and still have or have had a mental illness and continue to be on medication. Maybe I didn't have to embrace or reject the mental health industrial complex entirely. Maybe I could live without clarity or symptom lists or order or an answer. If I did, I had to accept my suicidality and pull it from the parentheses. Parentheses typify interiority and withholding. They date back to before the Renaissance. In the 16th century, the Dutch philosopher and scholar Desiderius Erasmus called them lunulae, little moons. One of their earliest uses was by the Elizabethan rhetorician, scholar, and scribe Angel Day. As a scribe, Day would have been privy to and trusted with his employer's secrets. Parentheses might be seen as a closed circle, a covenant, divided in two. The Oxford English Dictionary would later define them as an explanation, aside, or afterthought, without grammatical relevance to the rest of the sentence. Often, parenthetical punctuation marks, parentheses, dashes, and commas, are described as interchangeable. But parentheses couldn't be more different from dashes or parenthetical commas. Parentheses, at first, seem prohibitive. They take effort to get into. They stop us only to whisper an invitation for us to climb inside. Their inner thoughts and secrets. At my next appointment, I asked Dr. R about the long-term side effects of the drugs I was on. He looked out the window and paused. According to the literature, I mean, what we know now, it's unlikely. You mean now? There are some data. What we know now? No, there are no serious risks. I could have tried to find meaning in his words, the stuttered phrases between the quotation marks, decoded every comma, each period, the dash and ellipsis, the semicolon, the apostrophe, the question mark, every space. I could have ruminated on them, inserting slashes of indecision. Believe this, slash, that. Accept the diagnosis, slash, don't accept it. But I didn't. Epilogue. My new living room window gives me a view of the lake and the city skyline. The sun is rising, turning the horizon a deep pink hue. In the kitchen, on the counter, a new counter, this one speckled gray, sits my blue pillbox. I pop the tab. No longer meds, they're just pills I take. One gets stuck in my throat. The taste, tinny, lingers even after I wash it down with water. It's a luxury to refuse a diagnosis, or two, or four, or six, to refute the certainty presumed by the DSM. I'm not in crisis. My diagnosis wasn't forced on me as a method of social control. I don't need the diagnosis to receive disability payments. My pills work, though I don't know if they're needed to treat a condition or because my body is dependent on them. I found the right combination and dosage of medications, which is like finding the slimmest of needles in the largest of haystacks at the end of a rainbow after winning the lottery. It would be different if I were transgender and needed my diagnosis to receive medical care. Sadly, according to the DSM, being transgender is a mental illness. Originally called sexual deviation, then a personality disorder, then a sexual and gender identity disorder, it's now known as gender dysphoria. The authors of the DSM-5 insist the new label only applies to those in distress. That would be true if transgender people weren't forced to accept the diagnosis to get necessary treatments. Some find power in their diagnoses. When Asperger's was removed from the DSM-5 and replaced with autism spectrum disorder, the outcry from the Asperger's community was thunderous. Aspies, as they call themselves, relish the label given to them. It's part of their identity, offering access to treatment and a sense of belonging. But accepting the DSM's unsubstantiated diagnoses, believing them, applying them, becoming them, almost drove me to suicide. That time is filled with the joining of illogical thoughts using a comma. He says I'm sick, comma, so I must be sick. Lists of symptoms and side effects following a colon. She shows many of the symptoms, colon, inflated mood, depressive episodes, irritability. Hyphenated terms, direct, hyphen, to, hyphen, consumer, marketing. Unanswerable questions, am I really sick? Points when I should have put a stop to things. Enough. And given myself options. Bipolar/not bipolar. Alarm bells that should have sounded. Don't listen! ! But didn't. Questions still come. Had I made myself ill? Had I made it all up? Was it mental illness or the effects of medications? How much of it was me, and how much others telling me I was sick? How can I be on medication but reject a diagnosis? I have some answers. No, uncertain, a lot. Because I am. The power of suggestion may have played a role in how I became well. We're influenced by experts. Jean-Martin Charcot cured patients suffering from hysteria using hypnosis. The neurologist George Beard acknowledged the effect of expectation, which can be positive or negative depending on what we believe. Dr. R said he'd get me well, not medication-free, but functioning, often high-functioning, even whatever I imagine Google executive high-functioning to be. But I never believed him to be the mythical genius/irreverent doctor so often found in the classic mental illness memoir. He wasn't Sherman to my Kessa. He didn't make me well. My words to myself did. When I stopped labeling and talking to myself as a sick person, I no longer was one. Not that I'm emotionally at ease. I feel depression and anxiety, sometimes deeply, paralyzingly, but I don't have depression or anxiety. The stomach aches still come, as does the edginess, although I don't let it veer into splintering or cracking. No derealization or depersonalization, but plenty of loneliness and isolation, and solitude, and hope. Therapy never helped me understand myself better. Maybe I just didn't find the right therapist. My therapy sessions consisted of complaining and talking at length about situations and events that usually didn't deserve that much attention, or that became a bigger deal by talking about them. They kept me in the past. I want to live into my future. One thing did help me understand myself, or at least my mind and body, a little better. Evolutionary psychiatry. Unsurprisingly, my exposure to that branch of psychiatry started with a book. Physician and scientist Randolph Nessy's Good Reasons for Bad Feelings, Insights from the Frontier of Evolutionary Psychiatry. My father and I started having lunch together every Sunday. It quickly became one of the highlights of my week. I may have suggested we read Nessy's book, but most likely my father did. It was one of The Economist's books of the year, and my father is devoted to The Economist. Nessy offers a paradigm I'd never considered. Maybe emotions like anxiety and depression aren't pathological. Maybe they date back to primitive humankind and for some reason haven't been eliminated by natural selection. Anxiety, even edginess, may have helped primitive humans stay alert and run from lions on the veldt. According to some theories, depression might be a reasonable, even evolutionarily beneficial, way of responding to stress. Nessie applies the methods of evolutionary biology to offer an alternative psychiatric approach to the DSM symptom lists and tome of diagnoses. The mind is perfectly designed to respond to danger. The problem is that most people live comparatively free of threat. My often extreme emotions, responses, and thoughts are natural but no longer useful. They aren't necessarily a sign of disorder or disease. Sometimes painful emotions are necessary. Sometimes they're not. The emotion of depression, a slowing, a wait, could be the body's response to extended periods of the emotion of anxiety, rushes of adrenaline, edginess, the sense of splintering, and then cracking. What I liked most about Nessie's book is his transparency. He presents theories, not truths. Unlike the DSM's authors, he doesn't presume scientific authority where there is none. Evolutionary psychiatry isn't a treatment and has no ties to pharmaceutical companies. Nessie stresses that it offers only philosophical insights. Evolutionary psychiatry isn't perfect, but its insights helped me view my mind differently. The mind isn't some evil entity full of repression and hidden nightmares and driven by sinister ulterior motives and meanings. It's not a series of uncontrollable chemical imbalances and stray synapses and wayward neurons. Certainly, it's not the source of thoughts and behaviors that fall on symptom lists that qualify me for diagnoses in the DSM. It's a well-intended machine trying to keep me safe through worry, anxiety, dread, and depression. Even my suicidality could be understood as a natural, albeit incorrect, evolutionary response. It wasn't sinful or shameful or evidence of insanity. It wasn't driven by self-hatred. It was my primitive mind telling me that I was dependent on the collective to survive, and that if I was a burden and no longer reproducing or of use, altruistic suicide was the answer. None of that was relevant to my life. And my suicidality wasn't altruistic, but the brain may be conditioned to that evolutionary paradigm and perhaps had mistakenly offered suicide as a viable option. This is a simplistic view, one that doesn't take into account the torment of suicidality, which is a descent to a dark, excruciating place no one should ever have to go. But it's also more generous and less stigmatizing than others. I reject a diagnosis because none has been proven. But I have or had a mental illness, broadly and without definition. I have certain limitations, or if that sounds too ableist, follow certain guidelines. My body and mind demand a level of care that many don't need. I live simply, modestly. Most would call my existence decidedly dull. Healthy diet, little travel, lots of fresh air and exercise, no drugs, no alcohol, no caffeine, little sugar, routine schedule. I don't make these choices because I have a DSM diagnosis, or two, or four, or six. But to be well. I'm not anti-psychiatry, though there are plenty of reasons to be. Psychiatrists attend conferences at which their colleagues present data that support the use of psychiatric medications from research funded by the drug companies that produce those drugs. They fail to report their conflicts of interest. They accept gifts and samples from drug reps and then present their patients with a veritable buffet of drugs to choose from. Psychiatrists like Joseph Biederman, Charles Nemiroff, and Alan Schatzberg, the same Alan Schatzberg who passed off SSRI withdrawal as discontinuation syndrome, accepted millions from drug companies, or, in Schatzberg's case, held $4.8 million in stock holdings in the drug company he co-founded, which produced psychiatric medications he endorsed. Biederman helped to fuel a 40-fold increase from 1994 to 2003 in the diagnosis of pediatric bipolar disorder and proselytized the use of antipsychotics in children. As the director of the Johnson & Johnson Center for Pediatric Psychopathology Research at Massachusetts General Hospital, he accepted kickbacks from and promised Johnson & Johnson, producer of the antipsychotic Risperdal, which was marketed to children with pediatric bipolar disorder, that his studies would support the safety and effectiveness of Risperdal, aiding sales. Over his career, he accepted more than $1.6 million in consulting fees from drug companies, while conducting clinical trials that produced favorable outcomes for antipsychotics marketed by those drug companies to children. After a congressional investigation, he wasn't fired from either of his prestigious positions at Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital, and continued to teach aspiring psychiatrists. He wasn't reprimanded for accepting the money, only for not reporting it. There were few repercussions, the most severe being that he was prohibited from being paid by pharma for just 1 year and then monitored for just 2 years. Harvard saw a delay of consideration for promotion or advancement a suitable reparation, even though Biederman was already a full professor with the luxury of tenure. I'm not anti-medication, even though the outrage against Big Pharma is wholly justified. Drug companies ply academic psychiatrists with gifts and fund their research and call them key opinion leaders, which amounts to little more than paying them to promote their drugs. They get patients to diagnose and medicate themselves through Ask Your Doctor campaigns. They create diagnoses and epidemics, as in 1998, when GlaxoSmithKline requested FDA approval for Paxil and hired the PR firm Cohn & Wolf to market not the drug but generalized anxiety disorder, GAD, which soon reached epidemic proportions. The FDA allows off-label prescriptions, a multi-billion-dollar industry. The government permits direct-to-consumer advertising. Mental health organizations take drug company money, including NAMI, which apparently, between 1996 and mid-1999, took $11.72 million from Janssen, $2.08 million, Novartis, $1.87 million, Pfizer, $1.3 million, Abbott Laboratories, $1.24 million, Wyeth Ayrst Pharmaceuticals, $658,000, Bristol Myers Squibb, $613,505, and Eli Lilly. One could argue that there's no conflict of interest when an organization like NAMI takes drug company money, because it helps people with mental illnesses and people with mental illnesses take pharmaceutical drugs. But doing so creates suspicions of a quid pro quo relationship, especially when NAMI advises people to take said drugs. The Depression Awareness, Recognition, and Treatment (DART) program, promoted by the National Institute of Mental Health, was a team effort with drug companies to convince the public that depressive disorders were common, serious diseases treatable with medication. The anti-medication movement is, in many ways, misdirected and potentially harmful. No, we don't really know how psychiatric medications work, and yes, most arose from unethical conditions, and yes, they're overprescribed. But they help some of us, and some desperately need any help available. Going off medication, particularly without a physician's care, as some in the withdrawal community advise, can be very, very dangerous. Demonizing psychiatry and pill shaming doesn't get at the root of the problem. None of this corruption and confusion and misrepresentation and suffering could happen without the DSM. The DSM functions as the core of what John Sadler, professor of psychiatry and medical ethics, calls the mental health medical industrial complex. It's in the best interests of the stakeholders within that complex: drug companies, academic medical centers, the healthcare system, advertising and the media, and others, to protect the DSM. Psychiatrists, psychologists, researchers, and even the National Institutes of Health, NIH, still speak of DSM diagnoses as discrete disease entities. Others defend the DSM by saying that although its diagnoses don't offer validity, they have utility, meaning useful in a clinical setting. Some uphold the DSM on the basis that its diagnoses can be understood as having comparative validity with a correspondence to external reality. One of the largest stakeholders is biological psychiatry. Biopsychiatry may sound scientific, but it rests on theories, not findings. In over 20 years of research, it hasn't shown that DSM diagnoses are biological, yet the media, psychiatry, and pharma tell us they are. Biopsychiatry rests on three claims: DSM diagnoses are heritable and/or genetic, caused by chemical imbalances and visible on brain scans, none of which have been established. We don't know if DSM diagnoses really run in families or if they're caused by a flaw in one's genes. Chemical imbalances are, at this point, little more than a cultural myth. And the effects of mental suffering can't be definitively observed on brain scans. Schizophrenia is the most oft-cited diagnosis used to try to prove the mental disorders are biological theory. But as many have pointed out, the studies referred to don't prove what they're said to prove. In support of the schizophrenia runs in families conclusion, studies rely on the results of earlier studies that had inconsistent results, some of which were influenced by the eugenics movement. Adoption studies often rely on researcher bias. If a researcher goes in believing a diagnosis is caused by biology, that researcher will draw biological results from the data. If a researcher favors the environmental explanation, that researcher will find the influence of environment using the same data. Despite the allure of the defective gene theory, no single gene has been shown to cause any DSM diagnosis. Psychiatry shrugs this off by saying, right, well then it must be caused by multiple genes and it's just a matter of time until we obtain those findings. Brain imaging may look convincing, but the enlargement of certain areas and the loss of gray matter in the brains of study participants can be caused by myriad factors. Even the APA admits neuroimaging can't be used in diagnosis. It's not enough to say, as many mental health professionals do, well, yes, the DSM is seriously flawed, even useless, but it's all we have. The risks of labeling with an unfounded DSM diagnosis are too high. Stigma and self-stigma have so many adverse effects that it's hard to believe mental health professionals could justify using DSM diagnoses based on convenience, aka having supposed utility. Given how much damage DSM diagnoses can do, how can mental health professionals continue to use them without, at the very least, warning their patients and clients that the diagnoses they've received are hypothetical? There are many types of lies. The white lie, little and supposedly harmless. The unspoken lie of omission, the cover-up, the bluff. The blue lie, told in the name of the public good. Exaggeration, confabulation, where a person lies because he doesn't know the truth. The lie said in jest. Plato's noble lie, also translated as the magnificent myth, the pathological lie, the polite lie, the half-truth. St. Augustine distinguished between lies told out of pleasure versus those told out of harm. Lying is common, maybe even normal. Ironically, pathological lying isn't a diagnosis found in the DSM, though it is a symptom. One study found that adults said they lie at least once a day. Pinocchio had to lie to become a real boy. In Greek mythology, lying was considered a skill, which doesn't make it any less toxic. Christianity condemns it with its thou shalt not bear false witness. In Buddhism, lying is a betrayal. Hannah Arendt said that lying destroys a society to the point that we can no longer believe in anything, which robs us of our ability to act. Were the therapist in New York and Dr. B and the psychiatrist in Iowa City and Dr. C and Dr. H and Dr. M lying when they handed me my diagnoses? Did they lie when they let me believe my diagnoses were caused by chemical imbalances? Should they have warned me that the biological theory supported by the NIH, which states mental illness does indeed have a biological basis, wasn't proven? Did they see their diagnoses as little white lies? Or did they view themselves as part of an elite guild enacting Plato's noble lie to advance their agenda? Did they tell themselves that covering up psychiatry's falsehoods would, certainly, probably, maybe, benefit the many? Or did they rationalize that their lies of omission were justified because they were merely allowing me to play a part in my treatment, code for I should have known better? Did they tell themselves that since the brain disease theory would, certainly, probably, maybe, be proven in the future, what was the harm in a little half-truth? Right now, it falls to patients, mental health advocates, and potential patients, meaning everyone else, to create change. There's so much we can do. We can make sure that those with DSM diagnoses know that those diagnoses are opinions, not facts. Even the authors of the DSM, quietly, confess they're unfounded. In a statement made by David Kupfer, chair of the DSM-5, a statement rarely, if ever, mentioned in conversations about mental illness or by mental health organizations or in the media, and certainly not by any of the doctors I saw, he admitted that DSM diagnoses aren't based on biological markers, are imprecise, and can't be delivered with complete reliability and validity. Mental illness exists, but what we call major depression, anxiety disorder, ADHD, etc., are creations of the DSM. They lead to the problem of false positives, overdiagnosis, misdiagnosis, and the mislabeling of normal distress as a mental disorder, a problem that's only getting worse. Influential public figures and professionals can take care with what they say and write. When celebrities speak out about their diagnoses, they can tell their fans that DSM diagnoses are as yet unproven. Journalists can explain, or if we set the bar low, just mention, the complexities of saying that someone has any of the disorders listed in the DSM. Authors, editors, and publishers of books about mental health and mental illness memoirs can do their research and qualify the terms they use. We should talk about and tend to our mental and emotional health, but we can resist the urge to pathologize our thoughts and feelings and respect those in crisis. The phrase, everyone's a little mentally ill, doesn't destigmatize mental illness. It minimizes the conditions of those with serious mental illnesses, which can prevent resources going to them. This was the case with the Asperger's label. It was dropped from the DSM-5, in part because, as Task Force Chair of the DSM-5, David Kupfer, said, some of the funding for autism research wasn't going toward those with severe autism. We can reject spectrums that invite almost anyone to fall on them. The most recent edition of the DSM would like us to believe that mental illness is dimensional and that we're all just a doctor's office away from a diagnosis. We can be more skeptical of psychiatrists. A recent Gallup poll reported that Americans' trust in psychiatrists' honesty and ethical standards increased between 2003 and 2019. But given psychiatrists' lack of transparency about DSM diagnoses, have they really earned that trust? If a DSM diagnosis is unproven, invalid, possibly unreliable, and likely the result of lowered thresholds, what does that diagnosis really mean? We can also question the role primary care physicians play in diagnosing mental illness. They shouldn't be allowed to do so without additional training and certification in mental health. Knowing that DSM diagnoses haven't been proven to be chronic, we can consider suggested treatments more shrewdly. Physicians will need to explain how scientific studies on drug efficacy hold up without verifiable diagnoses. Psychiatric drug trials require all participants have the same diagnosis, e.g. depression. But if DSM diagnoses aren't valid, how can researchers know if participants have depression? Of what relevance are the results? If we accept a recommended treatment, we'll do so with the understanding that scientific studies having to do with the mind and behavior are often flawed and have been found to lack enduring value. We can demand not another DSM revision, but full-on DSM reform. As former NIMH director Thomas Insull writes, patients with mental disorders deserve better. We deserve DSM authors / task force members and leaders who don't take drug company money. 69% of the DSM-5's authors had financial ties to Big Pharma. Until psychiatry can provide real answers, we need to stop spreading awareness with false information about chemical imbalances and the other supposed causes of mental illness. Instead, let's publicize the absence of validity and scientific evidence and the presence of lowered thresholds in the DSM so people can make informed decisions about their diagnoses and treatment. Psychiatry's defense might be along the lines of, other fields of medicine have invalid diagnoses too. To that, we could answer, yes, but at least the majority of those are valid. If anyone can show that DSM diagnoses are scientifically proven, valid, and don't exhibit lowered thresholds, then by all means they should. In 2003, half a dozen members of Mind Freedom International, a patient advocacy group that lobbied against forced treatment, went on a hunger strike and asked the APA, NAMI, and the U.S. Office of the Surgeon General to provide any scientific evidence that proved, using a physical diagnostic exam, that any DSM diagnosis was a brain-based disease. No one could provide a single one. It's been nearly 2 decades, and we're still waiting. Some organizations and mental health practitioners have been and are working toward reform. In 2011, the Society for Humanistic Psychology, SHP, a division of the APA, wrote an open letter to raise concerns about the ethical and scientific implications of the DSM-5. They were concerned about the lowering of diagnostic thresholds, as well as the growing emphasis on biological theories. In light of the growing empirical evidence that neurobiology does not fully account for the emergence of mental distress, as well as new longitudinal studies revealing long-term hazards of standard neurobiological psychotropic treatment, we believe that these changes to the DSM pose substantial risks. They were ignored. Since then, the SHP has argued for a paradigm shift that would admit to the DSM's pathologizing of essentially normal human responses and has lobbied for the development of scientifically sound and ethically principled diagnostic manuals. The DSM-5 Task Force did invite the general public to weigh in on its revisions. Chair David Kupfer and Vice Chair Daryl Regier created a webpage to take outside feedback into account, but it's unclear how or if that really happened. The DSM-5 is now a digital, living document to which changes can be made at any time. Through an online portal, anyone can petition to have, say, obsessive-compulsive disorder or autism removed. Scientific data backing up suggested change is preferred, but not necessary. Although this democratizes the process by which feelings, thoughts, and behaviors are turned into illnesses and entered into the DSM, it doesn't exactly instill trust. Imagine the American Medical Association saying, all diagnoses, cancer, diabetes, pneumonia, hypertension, could be gotten rid of if you want. Or we could add a disorder, a disease, an illness based on your ideas and any data you can come up with. And if you think we should change the symptoms for a diagnosis or the level of dysfunction, just let us know because we've got precious little to go on. Individuals, organizations, and social media campaigns do try to warn people about DSM diagnoses. Mind Freedom International has been trying to warn the public about the DSM since 1986. Robert Whitaker's Mad in America, which includes a podcast, a webzine, and educational courses, has been critiquing it since 2012. The No DSM Diagnosis campaign attempted a boycott of the DSM in 2013. More recently, Facebook groups and virtual conferences like Drop the Disorder have called for us to challenge the DSM and improve how we refer to and speak about mental and emotional distress. The critical psychiatry movement, not to be confused with anti-psychiatry, has pointed to the lack of scientific evidence in psychiatric diagnoses and the skewed social and moral consequences of those diagnoses. Joanna Moncrief, Sandra Steingard, and others attempt to cull the best of psychiatry while acknowledging its worst. What's the alternative to the DSM? Other diagnostic systems aren't yet viable. The WHO's International Classification of Diseases doesn't suffer from the same financial conflicts as the DSM does and has fewer diagnoses, but it leaves even more to the discretion of the clinician and is thought to be less accurate. The NIMH's Research Domain Criteria, RDOC, focuses on degrees of dysfunction, which could lead to more diagnostic precision. Currently, however, the RDOC is still a research framework, not a diagnostic guide intended for clinical practice. Suggestions made by Nasir Gaimi, an attending psychiatrist and professor of psychiatry and pharmacology at Tufts University School of Medicine, and others advocate for reducing the number of DSM diagnoses. Gaimi has said we should return to the diagnoses from the finer criteria, remove the rest, and keep only those diagnoses that have the most viable research. No more inventing of diagnoses and clustering of symptoms and pathologizing emotions, thoughts, and behaviors based on the opinions and ideas of APA members and other mental health professionals. There are no easy answers, but we need to start having the right conversation, one that focuses on the dangers of the DSM. Even if we find an alternative to the DSM, it won't be easy to counteract the damage done by the DSM. Too many psychiatrists won't admit the truth. One need only read Shrinks, The Untold Story of Psychiatry by Jeffrey Lieberman, former head of the APA. Lieberman glosses over the fact that no DSM diagnosis is scientifically valid and proclaims that psychiatry is a medical specialty on the verge of greatness. Psychiatry is finally taking its rightful place in the medical community after a long sojourn in the scientific wilderness. He boasts that during the DSM-5 revisions, the task force adopted the strictest ethics policy, and that psychiatrists' dealings with drug companies must be transparent, rigorously monitored, and without conflicts of interest. His solution wasn't that anyone stopped taking drug company money and inventing diagnoses. Just admit they took the money, at least most of the time. Lieberman's own close ties to Big Pharma, 15 companies, according to infectious disease specialist and writer Judith Stone, and inaccurate findings about the effectiveness of antipsychotics seemed to trouble him not at all. Like many psychiatrists, Lieberman could be said to suffer from hubris. Biederman certainly did. During his 2009 deposition, Biederman was asked about his rank at Harvard Medical School. He answered, "Full professor." When asked what was above that, Biederman said, "God." Dr. M exuded hubris, albeit subtly. His excessive self-confidence revealed itself in his need to be right about my diagnosis. If asked, he, like many psychologists and psychiatrists, might have claimed that it had nothing to do with the DSM, because the DSM doesn't reflect how he actually conducts his practice. But instead of helping me understand that my diagnosis was hypothetical, he made it more real. He failed to heed the advice found in the Intelligent Clinician's Guide to the DSM-5. In the absence of independent measures, we cannot be sure that any category in the manual is valid. We should not therefore think of current psychiatric diagnoses as real in the same way as medical diseases. Also, listing diagnoses in a manual does not make them real. Psychiatrists must make diagnoses, but they do not need to reify them. They are best advised to stay humble and to avoid hubris. I wouldn't have minded any of my diagnoses if he and Dr. H and Dr. C and Dr. B and the psychiatrists in Iowa City had been honest. If just one, aside from Dr. R, had admitted to not knowing, it could be major depression or an anxiety disorder or ADHD or bipolar or... But those diagnoses have never been proven. It's a theoretical diagnosis, an idea about a diagnosis you can choose to accept or not. Oh, and here are drugs you can take, which are equally unproven. Oh, and you may have terrible side effects, and you may never be able to go off this one drug, and I may still have accepted the diagnoses I received. Given the severity of what I was experiencing, I might have taken the medications prescribed. But my decisions wouldn't have been based on lies of omission. I sit at one of the tables in my creative writing workshop. The discussion is animated. The class is made up of juniors and seniors who don't have much confidence in their writing, but are very, very sociable. They've bonded over the quarter and come to trust each other. The story we're workshopping is by a student whose talent astounds me. He seems to have an internal understanding of characterization and description. His punctuation and grammar skills are excellent. The main character in the story is an anti-hero, rough and unpleasant. By the end, he becomes violent. His violence is explained not as a complicated mix of factors, impulses, desires, socioeconomic conditions, skewed beliefs, and mistakes, but with two words: mental illness. I sip my water and listen as the students tell the writer what they think is working in the story. After they share their thoughts for revision, I ask them if the character has to have a mental illness. They look at me like I've asked them to stop scrolling on their phones forever. Total incomprehension. One student says, "It explains him and what he does." I ask if that's true. Do they understand the character better with that identity? Some say no. Others stick with yes. After class, I walk through the hallway crowded with students. Three young men in front of me jostle each other. Someone shouts. A young woman passes with tears in her eyes. All I have is the knowledge that DSM diagnoses are easy to get and aren't to be trusted. More than 46% of American adults and 20% of children and adolescents will receive a DSM diagnosis in their lifetimes. Picture a stadium full of adults. Half of them will think they have a mental illness. Imagine a playground full of children. One in five of them will be told they are mentally ill. Few, if any of them, will be told that their diagnoses come from a book that's primarily a collection of relatively common behaviors, thoughts, and emotions that have been ordered and reordered and pathologized, or that those diagnoses can't be proven to exist and are opinions, not facts. As mentioned, exceptions include dementia and rare chromosomal disorders. Because that would make people wary. And the DSM is designed to diagnose as many people as possible. It does this by adding new diagnoses and subtypes, e.g. binge eating disorder, and including milder versions of diagnoses, e.g. bipolar 2, and lowering standards to include and keep the most unreliable of diagnoses, e.g. generalized anxiety disorder and major depressive disorder, and by replacing words and inserting punctuation, say, a slash. I give you this. Before you accept a DSM diagnosis, pause. That doesn't mean you don't seek treatment or take medication or ultimately decide that having a diagnosis, no matter how tenuous, at least for now, serves you. But you do so knowing the truth. This is Gabor Zacman. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Pathological, The True Story of Six Misdiagnoses by Sarah Fay, presented by Harper One and Harper Audio. This program was produced by John Marshall Media. Executive producer, Pavel Rivera. Text copyright 2022 by Sarah Fay. Production copyright 2022 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.